Hi, and welcome to Prosody, 90.5 FM's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the writer Alexandra Fuller. Alexandra Fuller has written four books of nonfiction. Her new book, Cocktail Hour Under the Tree of Forgetfulness, was just released by Penguin in August of 2011. Her first book, Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight, published by Random House in 2001, was a national bestseller, a New York Times notable book of 2002, the 2002 BookSense Best Nonfiction Book, a finalist for the Guardian First Book Award, and the winner of the 2002 Winifred Holtby Memorial Prize. Her 2004 book, Scribbling the Cat, Travels with an African Soldier, published by Penguin, was on the New York Times extended bestseller list and won the Ulysses Prize for Art of Reportage. The Legend of Colton H. Bryant, the biography of a young Wyoming oil rig worker who fell to his death, was published in May 2008 by Penguin and was a Toronto Globe and Mail Best Nonfiction Book of 2008. So I want to welcome Alexandra Fuller. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, we're excited. You're at the end of your book tour, and so I know that means you're raring to go here. So you're going to read from your new book.
I should start before I read by saying that my mother would tell me the story about when she was growing up in Kenya, she says, Kenya, as I would say. They would go to England on a ship for leave every few years. And my mother's memory of these of being on the ship was that when the ship crossed the equator, for reasons that astonish me but don't necessarily surprise me, the British would bring dead fish out of a bucket and slap you over the face with it. And my mother says, and then the next awful thing was the ghastly fancy dress parties where you were forced into these costumes and paraded around the hot deck. So with that in mind, I shall read. So here we are, Mum, now in her early 30s, having apparently learned nothing from her experience as a child, dressing Vanessa and me up for the Davis's annual fancy dress. An event I might not have dreaded at all if Mum hadn't chosen costumes of such agonizing inventiveness that it's a wonder they didn't kill us. Why can't I be like Vanessa? I asked. Because, Mum said. But I'm itchy, I complained. Olivia, my baby sister, was only 4 months old, too small to be anything murderous, so Mum had dressed her in a homemade rainbow-colored tie-dyed onesie as the Summer of Love. Vanessa was a rose, hypoallergenic and splendid, in a pink tutu, pink tights, and pink belly slippers. I was, I never promised you, a rose garden in an old vest and a pair of knickers inside an empty insecticide drum, on which Mum had pasted a few pictures of weeds cut from the pages of Farmers Weekly. No one's going to understand what I am, I pointed out. The clever ones will, Mum said. Now hold still, I don't want to poke your eyes out. It was the sound of Mum attacking the insecticide drum with scissors. I think I'm getting a rash, I said. I can feel bumps. Mum started to sing. I beg your pardon. I never promised you a rose garden. There was a pause, followed by a couple more violent assaults against the insecticide drum. Then Mum said to Vanessa, go to the kitchen and fetch me a knife, would you, Vanessa? Ask July for a nice sharp one. I can't breathe, I said. Oh, buck up, Bobo. Wouldn't it be easier if I got out? No, it wouldn't. But then you won't poke my eyes out. Whoever said anything about poking eyes out? You did. Don't exaggerate. I could hear Vanessa rustle demurely back into the room. Thank you, darling, Mum said. She only called one of us darling when she wanted to imply that the other was not, at that moment, darling. You're such a big help, Mum said. I didn't need to be on the outside of my insecticide drum to see the pink ruffles on Vanessa's tutu puffing up. Now hold still, Bobo. There were flashes from a knife blade and two slits of light appeared. Are those near your eyes? No, I said, and then I reconsidered my close escape. Yes, I said, yes, very. There we go then, Mum said. I'll just get my Uzi and we'll be off. Bullets, lipstick, sunglasses. Off we go. Come on, Bobo, quick march. My feet poked out of two holes in the drum's lid. I couldn't walk very well. I had to waddle like a penguin. This amused Vanessa and her peals of laughter echoed around inside the insecticide drum. Mum, with Olivia on her hip, helped me out of the big door, down the rough stone steps, and onto the veranda. Don't fall, Vanessa said, barely able to contain the hope in her voice. It was very hot inside the drum, and sweat poured into my already stinging eyes and onto my increasingly stinging rash. I'm boiling, I whined. One more word out of you, Mum warned. We scuffled across the yard and into the driveway and arrived at Lucy, the mineproof Land Rover, where a problem presented itself. I didn't fit through any of the doors. Oh dear, Mum said, an unforeseen hitch. There was a silence while she had a think. I pictured her biting the inside of her lower lip and frowning. When she spoke again, she sounded struck by inspiration. We'll push her in the back, she paused. Darling, she said, not to me, go and fetch July and Violet. So Vanessa called July from the kitchen and she fetched Violet from the laundry. Then there was general hilarity while July and Violet each considered how amazing it was that the madam had put her young daughter into an insecticide drum. Mum explained that when she was in labor with me in England, the radio was playing I Never Promised You a Rose Garden, which was prophetic because when I arrived, I really was, as promised, not a rose garden. Mum has refused to waver from the story, even though I have since discovered the song became a hit for Lynn Anderson a full year and a half after I was born, and therefore could not have been playing when she was in labor with me. She had yellow skin and black hair. That's why we called her Bobo, Mum explained, because she looked just like a little baboon.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the writer Alexander Fuller, the author of Cocktail Hour, Under the Tree of Forgetfulness. I'm still back on slapping people with fish when they when they cross the equator. Really, that happened?
That's what my mother said. You know, I think that the British had a sort of, I don't know, I think an institutionalized boarding school mentality that they took with them out to the colonies. And actually, my parents, you know, were raised in, at the time when the British Empire was waning, you know, by the time my mother was born, India was 1 year away from independence, which was an enormous chunk of the empire. But the mentality that had gone with having that power still remained very much in the minds of people like my parents. And so there was, I think, this sort of idea that if you weren't British, then your culture was just a failed attempt at being British. And if you would just allow yourself to be colonized, everything would be fine. Mm-hmm. And so really, for me, in a way, the way that this book especially is very different from the memoir I wrote of my own childhood growing up in Rhodesia, is that my parents undergo this amazing arc through their lives, coming from that British background and the silliness of the British in Kenya at the time, the whole Happy Valley sort of hedonistic crowd who, you know, went out there and shot animals in droves and snorted heaps of cocaine and drank themselves silly and, you know, behaved in this sort of way that was just so irresponsible and ignored the fact that they were oppressing, you know, millions and millions of people to do so, that my parents came out of not particularly that tradition, but a tradition where certainly that was around them, to a place where by their late lives, when most people's beliefs and ideas and identities about themselves have calcified into something immovable, where they decided that actually being British was what would kill them, if not literally, metaphorically. And they made a decision to become African, truly.
Mm-hmm. I know in the writing of this book, you interviewed your mother at length. And can you talk about that process of interviewing your mother and how it changed your writing process, if it did, and if there were any moments that, you know, your mother in the book is very outspoken and very wild and cinematic and large. So was there any moment when you felt like you had to not say something in your book?
Well, I am as uncensored as my mother. For me, not putting something in the book really has to do not so much with being concerned about the material. It's whether it makes the material readable or not. I think the trick with creative nonfiction is what you leave out, not what you put in. I mean, if you're just sort of slapping everything in there, then it's really a journal and it's dreary. And my mother was the one who taught me about storytelling. I mean, when I was young and following her around the farm, I was very little, probably 5 or 6 years old, sort of in her wake, as she charged around the farm on her horse or on foot or whatever she was doing. I would witness the whole day as she was seeing it. But at night, what I would witness was even more beautiful, which was the alchemy of her storytelling. So, you know, we didn't have electricity or television or any of those distracting things when I was growing up. So at night by candlelight at dinner, what I would get to see as my mother telling my father the story of our day. Mm-hmm. And I could see how she edited out the boring, dreary bits, the heat and the anguish and the strain. And what you were left with was this incredible vividness, mm-hmm. The startling clarity of her language, mm-hmm. And her humor. She's terribly, terribly funny. Mm-hmm. In the interviews that I conducted with her, she was so furious about my first book, Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight. She said, you don't know who I am. You don't know my motivations. You know nothing about me. And in a way, it's true. I mean, which of us do know our mothers? We know
or anyone.
Or anyone, probably. Yeah. And so to sit down and give her the dignity and respect of her time with a tape recorder and to let her tell her own story felt like the least I could do. But my overall emotional impression of the interviews was that they were quite hostile and felt a bit like a eugenics lesson. My mother sort of saying, I'm 200,000,000% Highland Scottish blood, and you were probably switched at birth. And even if you weren't, I think there's rumors of Armenian blood on your father's side of the family, and I'm sure it all got distilled in you, and so on and on and on. And so it wasn't until a couple of years ago I'd given up the idea of writing this book, because I really felt as if there was so much sort of hostility behind my mother's world philosophy and this determination that she had this kind of incredible superiority complex, which I don't share. A couple of years ago, I got whooping cough, which, unless you have a pre-existing condition that forbids it, I highly recommend. I was so sick that everyone left me alone for about 3 months, and I got through a pile of reading. And then I went upstairs and got these tapes. And it turns out that a fever of 101 degrees Fahrenheit, the precise remove with which to hear my mother. Because I could finally get through the judgment,
yeah.
And even past the compassion to a place of absolutely knee-buckling awe of who she was, mm-hmm. what she had managed to achieve in her life, considering the accumulation of loss mm-hmm. that she had had.
Yeah, and there's so much loss in the book. Could you read some more?
I'd love to. One of the things that has been difficult to witness has been what's happened to Zimbabwe since 1980, after all the hope and promise, the end of the war, and the way that independence started out with this idea that we really had a chance as Zimbabweans to reclaim ourselves and our land. And then, you know, Robert Mugabe has ended up being one of the grand monsters of Africa, his absolutely hideous, smart genocide against his own people, meaning that instead of killing a whole people, you just kill the people who will hurt the most. So children are getting killed, very young women and girls being raped, and people being maimed and hurt in such a way that it's a very effective genocide. It effectively silences people. And because of the way Mugabe's behaved, I think there's this kind of instinct or urge for a lot of ex-Zimbabweans, or indeed, in fact, the world, to be revisionist about what Rhodesia was, that, oh, well, then perhaps it wasn't so bad under Ian Smith. But it was bad. It was very bad for the 6 million black Rhodesians who lived during that war. And we tend to forget exactly how oppressive and toxic and ruining the regime of Ian Smith was, and that Mugabe did not come out of a place of love and tranquility. That kind of hatred, that long half-life of violence that he represents, came out of a place of real danger and real oppression. So I'd like to read some of the commandments of that oppression. So 11 days after my baby sister Olivia drowned, the Rhodesian government distributed pamphlets in the tribal trust lands with 9 new instructions for black civilians. Number 1, human curfew from last light to 12 o'clock daily. Number 2, cattle, yoked oxen, goats, and sheep curfew from the last light to 12 o'clock daily. Number 3, no vehicles, including bicycles and buses, to run either in the tribal trust land or the African purchase land. Number 4, no person will either go on or near any high ground or they will be shot. Number 5, all dogs to be tied up 24 hours each day or they will be shot. Number 6, cattle, sheep, and goats after 12 o'clock are only to be herded by adults. Number 7, No juveniles to the age of 16 years will be allowed out of the corral area at any time, either day or night, or they will be shot. Number 8, no schools will be open. Number 9, all stores and grinding mills will be closed.
You know, we were talking a little before this, and you were saying, you know, some of the most horrific things on that list are, you know, number 7 about, you know, shooting the children. Why is that number 7 on the list? I mean, it's just, you know, unimaginable.
Well, I think what it demonstrates is the shocking callousness with which the Rhodesian government viewed black life. Mm-hmm. And again, I think it's something that is left out of the conversation when we discuss Mugabe, that he did not come out of a creative environment. And we are, I think, as Zimbabweans, not a good example, but we are a terrible warning that eventually you will reap what you sow.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I like how all of this gets complicated in the book between the voice of the mother, which is definitely not politically correct in any way, how that, you know, some things that the mother says in the book are kind of shocking in terms of race. Mm-hmm. And as you said, this idea of, you know, the British are superior. I mean, that comes out in the book. And yet you were talking about the journey that your parents have made towards being less racist.
Completely gone. Utterly. Yeah. I mean, there was this moment that what that cost them. I think what most people don't understand is that in this country in general, in the United States, you can get away with having all sorts of prejudices and crazy beliefs. And you don't really pay very heavily for those beliefs. But where my parents were in Rhodesia, if you held those beliefs, you had to back them up with a gun. My father was sent to fight a bush war for 6 months of every year until he was 40 years old. I think if people had to back up what they say they believe, mm-hmm. with the possibility that they would lose blood, limbs, or their life over it, people would re-examine how strongly held their beliefs right. were. And so I, in a way, admire that my parents had these beliefs. I don't admire the beliefs, but I admire that they had these beliefs that they passionately backed up with their lives, their blood, their sweat. The result, however, is that it takes such an incredible amount of focus, that there's such a sort of weather system of hatred going on, that it will leak into your homes. Mm-hmm. As a child growing up, I didn't understand that there was such a concept as peace. Mm-hmm. It didn't occur to anyone to explain to me that war was not a usual state of being. Mm-hmm. So I didn't know that there was anywhere in the world where there was peace. And I think we forget that in the two wars that we're fighting in Afghanistan and Iraq, that there will be children there, mm-hmm. and whose entire weather system will have been to have grown up at war with the United States. Mm-hmm. My parents, in their case, not directly as a result of the war, but I think directly as a result of being in the country of Rhodesia, lost 3 children, mm-hmm. ultimately lost the war. They lost land. Mm-hmm. And that accumulation of loss, my mother eventually lost her mind.
Yeah.
And it really wasn't until they were down to nothing. They didn't even have a roof over their head. Somebody had lent them a cottage to live in, that my father went on what I can only really describe as a vision quest. He walked to the top of the Zambezi Escarpment and sat out there and smoked his way through a couple of boxes of cigarettes for a long, long time and just thought. And it finally came to him. Africa is for the Africans. That the only way for my parents to remain where they were is to remove the sort of sticky idea of being British, mm-hmm. and to fully embrace being African, mm-hmm. which is a lot more alarming and difficult than it sounds if you think that they had made all the sacrifice and now in a way it would look like a sort of reversal of that sacrifice, or as if the sacrifice was quote unquote for nothing, mm-hmm. you know, for them to come in and say, no, this is Africa's for the mm-hmm. Africans, we will now be here. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, through all that well of loss, and it is just this well that goes down and mm-hmm. deep and deep, really what was at the bottom of it was an African kind of peace, which is to accept, this is our land, we will be buried here. And so my father went on bended knee to the headman of the village as a subject of the headman and said, I am your subject. Mm-hmm. I need 100 acres. And by then my parents were so poor. It took several years for all the various sort of slow Zambian machine to sort of churn and resolve itself into a land lease. But my parents did eventually end up with a farm mm-hmm. of 100 acres, a very small farm. But by then they were so poor, they qualified for 2 free donkeys from the Zambian Minister of Agriculture, which is quite an achievement. My mother, with an incredible optimism, did call the donkeys flash and lightning.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the writer Alexandra Fuller, and she's reading from her new book, Cocktail Hour, Under the Tree of Forgetfulness. Can you read some more?
My mother has no patience with questions that begin, what if? But I spend a great deal of my time circling that insensible eddy. What if we had been thinking straight? What if the setting of our lives had been more ordinary? What if we had tempered passion with caution? What ifs are boring and pointless, Mum says. Because however close to irreparably deep madness my mother has gone in her life, she does not now live in a ruined, regretful Miss Havisham world, and she doesn't wish any of her life away, even the awful, painful, damaging parts. What ifs are the worst kind of postmortem, she says, and I hate postmortems. Much better to face the truth, pull up your socks, and get on with whatever comes next. So the truth is this, it's towards the end of the war. Fanda everything, and our collective thinking has been so shaken up by the hallucinatory, seductive violence of it all that we can't see our way even to a safer address somewhere else in Rhodesia, let alone out of the country. In any case, it doesn't occur to us to leave. We see our lives as fraught and exciting, terrible and blessed, wild and ensnaring. We see our lives as Rhodesian, and it's not easy to leave a life as arduously rich and difficult as all that. In addition, leaving was treason talk, cowardly stuff. Mum makes a fist. The Fullers aren't wimps, she says. No, you don't walk away from a country you say you love without a fight, just because things get rough. So the war escalated until very few families, rural, urban, black or white, were untouched by it. And still we held on.
For our listeners, do you think you could talk a little bit about the Tree of Forgetfulness? I love that name, but I also love how that tree figured into the book. I don't know if you want to give that away, but it had a lot of power in the book. And it, you know, speaking of War and Peace,
the farm that my parents were finally given to work by the headman. To begin with, there was no structures on it whatsoever. They lived in a tent. And when they decided to build a structure, which is a roof with a very small wall around it, a sort of shack, my mother spotted this tree. It's a barren, very hot, it's a very inhospitable area where they are. And Mr. Zulu, who is my father's sort of right-hand man, my mom said, what tree is this? It wasn't something she was familiar with. And he said, no, then this tree... Down here, they call this the Tree of Forgetfulness. My mother said, what's that? And Mr. Zulu said, no, here the headman, every headman in a village must have this tree. It's the place where all people can sit under it and you can commune with your ancestors, which my mother loves that idea because she's Scottish, so she's very close to ghosts and fairies and ancestors. But so it turns out are the Goba people. And certainly in that tradition, your ancestors are far wiser than you since they have been around longer and are prepared to give you advice. So it's a form of prayer, really. But it's also where people go to gather and resolve their differences. I love that idea. I also love the idea, Mr. Zulu told my mother, that this tree can be just grown from a cutting. You can just take a branch of it and put it in the ground and it will become a tree. What I love about that is by the time my mother got to this farm where the Tree of Forgetfulness is, I think that that's what she was. She was just a cutting. There had been so much taken away from her. She was really just the strong spiritual core of herself. And she planted herself in that tough, inhospitable, difficult, hot land. And she's thrived.
Yeah, there's a lot of large cinematic moments in the book, and it's not just the mother, it's the landscape, and it's at this new this last farm. There's a part where you visit them, and it was kind of scary, but I was scared often reading the book, but all these frogs everywhere, and I think there was a moment where you wrote that, you know, you would go to sleep and you wake up with a frog on your face, and there were frogs hanging.
Well, full disclosure, the frog on my face was after I had a good part of a box of very cheap South African wine and taken a sleeping pill. So my mother said, "How lucky! Think of all the mosquitoes it ate all night."
But all the snakes and the, oh my, yeah, it's a very intense book, and you speak about courage, the courage of your mother, and all levels of it. I think that, you know, there's a piece at the end that I wanted to make sure that you got in. Do you want to read that piece?
We're having this conversation on a late afternoon walk back from the Zambezi River to the Tree of Forgetfulness. The dogs surge ahead of us, rooting out snake smells and scaring up locusts the size of small pigeons. So yes, Mum agrees, I am mad. We all know that, but it's not a problem. It's nothing chirochemists can't put right. Suddenly she puts her binoculars to her eyes with a little gasp of excitement and says, "Look, a paradise flycatcher. How wonderful, what a glorious tail. Did you see it?" But she doesn't offer me her binoculars. Off he goes there, look at him, swoop, swoop. Mum inhales deeply, a soft smile on her lips. "Ah, I love the evenings," she says. "Such a reward after the daily toil, isn't it?" And she's right. The evenings here on the north bank of the Zambezi River are tremulously beautiful. A shaky ribbon of blue smoke from a nearby villager's cooking fire hangs over the farm. Emerald-spotted doves are calling, "My mother is dead, my father is dead, my relatives are dead," and my heart goes dum, dum, dum. Frogs are bellowing from the causeway. The air boils with beetles and cicadas, mosquitoes and tsetse flies. Egrets, white against the grey-pink sky, are floating upriver to roost in the winterthorn trees in the middle of Dad's bananas. "I won't let him chop down those trees," Mum says. "The birds love them." But you can't have all this life on one end without a corresponding amount of death and decay on the other. In the morning, my parents' maid, Hilda Tembo, will sweep up half a bucket of insect carcasses and two gecko bodies from under the Tree of Forgetfulness. Months from now, three of the Jack Russells will have been killed by a cobra in Dad's office, and one will have been eaten by a crocodile in Mum's fish ponds. And Dad will walk out of the bedroom one morning to see a python coiled in cartoonish perfection around Wallace, the late cat. "You learn not to mourn every little thing out here," Mum says. She shakes her head. "No, you can't, or you'd never, ever stop grieving." What my mother won't say, lost in all her talk of chemicals and pills, is that she knows not only the route grief takes through blood, but also the route it takes through the heart's cracks. What she won't tell me is that recovering from the madness of grief wasn't just a matter of prescriptions, but of willpower. I sometimes used to envy the people you see running up and down the Kafui Road in Hessian sacks, she said once. And it is true that Mum seriously considered that level of deep, irretrievable insanity an option. But instead she took a different route, and she regained herself. And that had very little to do with the very talented psychiatrist, and everything to do with forgiveness. She forgave the world, and her mind returned. She gave herself amnesty, and her soul had a home again. The forgiveness took years, and it took this farm, and it took the Tree of Forgetfulness. It took all of that. But above all, it took the one thing grief could never steal from my mother, her courage.
That's the work of Alexandra Fuller, reading from her book, Cocktail Hour Under the Tree of Forgetfulness. Thank you so much. It was great.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Prosody, a weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in at our new time, Saturday mornings at 6:30, for Prosody, 90.5 FM.